This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. 150 years ago, the war that divided the states took place right here at various locations in eastern North Carolina with the Battle of Bentonville, the Battle of Plymouth, and the Battle of Kinston. Since it's spring break, staycation ideas may include historic Civil War sites. The North Carolina Department of Tourism recently unveiled a new statewide Civil War trails guide to help you plan your trip. Tourism Development Manager Andre Neighbors says he's expecting people from around the country and around the world to visit eastern North Carolina historic sites as the sesquicentennial anniversary of the Civil War winds down.
We think that North Carolina is going to see a pretty huge influx of travelers, just learning more about North Carolina's role, which was such a huge event for our country.
The new North Carolina Civil War Trails Guide is available online at civilwartrails.com and in print at historic sites across the state. The idea for the guide was proposed in the early 2000s. The Department of Tourism, the Department of Cultural Resources, and the Historic Sites Division worked together to identify places in the state where significant military action took place. The original Civil War Trails Guide was released a decade ago.
There's just such a huge draw of folks throughout the country, as well as internationally as well, that are interested in Civil War tourism and visiting these trails. So they use this guide to be able to visit a lot of the sites throughout the state.
The Civil War Trails program started in Virginia and now includes Tennessee, Maryland, North Carolina, and West Virginia. As you travel around those states, you may see the Civil War Trail signs on the side of the road.
No matter where you are, when you see that logo sign on the side of an interstate off an exit, or if you're just traveling down a country road and you see that bugle logo, you know you're close to a Civil War Trails marker.
The Civil War Trails Guide highlights 231 historical sites in 79 North Carolina counties. Most of the state's trail signs are located in eastern North Carolina because this region served as the primary battleground in the state during the Civil War. The Battle of New Bern took place on March 14, 1862, when Union soldiers, under the direction of General Ambrose Burnside, sought to capture New Bern. The town was a strategic military target because the Atlantic and North Carolina railroads were located here. Around 7:30 on Friday morning, the Battle of New Bern commenced as Union troops pushed their way past Confederate lines. In only 6 hours, the vastly outnumbered and ill-equipped Confederate troops retreated, leaving New Bern in Union control for the remainder of the war. Steve Schaefer is a volunteer guide at the New Bern Battlefield Park.
People will enjoy seeing how well these historical places, redoubts, redans, entrenchments, have been preserved over the years.
Schaefer says $5 guided walking tours of the battlefield can be made by contacting the New Bern Historical Society. Another eastern North Carolina stop on the Civil War's trail guide is Fort Macon at Atlantic Beach. The fortress was constructed in 1834 on the eastern end of Bogue Banks to defend the entrance to the ports of Morehead City and Beaufort. After Union General Burnside's victory in New Bern on March 14, 1862, he turned his focus to capturing the Beaufort port. After three commands to surrender were given, Burnside laid siege to Fort Macon starting on Friday, April 25th. Park Ranger Paul Branch.
The morning at 5:40, the Union guns opened fire on the fort and bombed it for 11 hours. The fort resisted the ships of the Union Navy, which joined in, drove them away after an hour and a half. And then Union artillery fire was very destructive. Their artillery fire was concentrated at the gunpowder magazines, and the main magazine of the fort was cracking open, and it had 5 tons of gunpowder in it. So the Confederates were about to get blown up by their own gunpowder.
The next morning, the Confederate flag was lowered, and the Union took control of Fort Macon. Today, the fort is open to the public to explore daily from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. for free. Guided and self-guided tours are available. You can find a number of stops on the Civil War Trails Guide in Kinston, including markers for the Battle of Wise Fork, the First Battle of Kinston, and the CSS News State Historic Site. Civil War historian Andrew Dubstadt explains the role of the gunboat CSS News.
She was launched in April of 1864. To undertake an operation against New Bern. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough water in the river and she ran aground and got hung up. At that point, the Confederate Army had already been called back to the Virginia front by Robert E. Lee, so in about a month, the water rose and the ship floated, but with no troop support for the operation, they simply returned to their dock in Kinston and remained there for the next 10 months.
Eventually, the ironclad was later burned by the crew in 1865 to prevent capture. In addition to seeing what's left of the boat, you can tour a full-size replica of the CSS Neuse in downtown Kinston, open most Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. If you don't mind traveling, two new stops on the Civil War trails were added just this month in the central part of the state. The updated map includes a stop where the Emancipation Proclamation was read to former slaves who built St. Philip's Moravian Church. The other site is located at Lewisburg College in Franklin County, where several encampments were recorded. To learn more, download the Civil War Trails Guide from www.civilwartrails.com. Paper maps are also available at historic sites throughout the state.
This is the Down East Journal. I'm Mac McKee. April is designated as National Poetry Month, and we have a special guest with us on the program, Joseph Bethanty. Since August of 2012, he was appointed by former Governor Bev Perdue as Poet Laureate of North Carolina.
Thanks, Mac. It's really good to be here. The Poet Laureate in our state is the official ambassador of reading, writing, and literature and literacy. He or she travels around the state, typically to libraries, colleges, hospitals, prisons, and I also have a signature project that I've been working on since I was installed, and that's working with returning combat veterans, all veterans really, and their families to harvest their wartime stories through poems, short stories, you name it, memoir. So it encompasses a pretty wide swath of experiences.
Now, although you're a native of Pittsburgh, you came to North Carolina in the 1970s as part of the Volunteers in Service to America program. How did your service in VISTA prepare you for your current career?
I tell you, Mac, I was assigned to the North Carolina Department of Correction. It was in 1976. I knew nothing about prisons and that world. But I worked for 14 months doing basic kinds of things like teaching people to read and adult basic literacy. I did some coaching. I also taught some creative writing, and I moved around the state quite a bit. So it kind of got me on my feet and acquainted with the state and acquainted with dealing with all sorts of populations.
Now, did you find, particularly in the prison populations, did you find many of your audiences very receptive to poetry in general?
Yeah, I really did. Strikes me, Mac, that everyone has a story. Any person you meet on the street has a story and has his or her own arsenal of language. So I think as much as anything, the kind of work I'm trying to do at the grassroots level is to connect people with their stories and with their languages and with their communities and get them to tell about it.
Now, is your presentation, a part lecture and reading?
I'm bopping all over the state, and I read my work, but I also teach workshops to adults and children, just kind of expose them broadly to poetry, the fact that it's written, the fact that they can write it, and also a poem comes alive, I think, when somebody actually reads it.
Now, in addition to poetry, you've also written a volume of short stories, a novel, and a literary history nonfiction in North Carolina. Do you feel confident in all three milieus, and which one is your favorite of all three?
When I feel like I want to write something about something, whatever that might be, my initial impulse is really to write a poem. But often that's not the proper vessel for what it is I'm looking at. The writing tends to be smarter than the writer, if that makes any sense. So sometimes it has a mind of its own, and you have to go where it leads.
Do you see a resurgence in interest in poetry?
North Carolina, if we could just take North Carolina, it is just rife with poets. Every county, every town, there are writing groups, the community colleges offer classes, the university offers classes, there are more literary magazines, more small presses. So poetry has never died. It's actually thriving in ways it never has. Just take it off the pedestal and demystify it and allow people to realize that it is like democracy. It's absolutely for everybody.
Now, who are some of the poets that influenced you as a young poet, and do they have the same influence on you today?
There was a poet named Robert Lowell, who was one of the great poets of the middle part of the century, and also a poet named Elizabeth Bishop. I have so many other influences. I loved reading Sylvia Plath. The first poems that really grabbed me were those poems that were autobiographical, were narrative, were talking often about family. They were templates that I felt like I could plug my own writing and life into.
Professor Bethany, how can our listeners find out more about you and your writing?
Joseph Bethany at WordPress. I'm also blogging every day of April, and that can be found at North Carolina Arts Council website. And, of course, I'm delighted to come to communities whenever I'm invited.
Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you.
You can watch Poet Laureate Joe Bethany share his poem, You're Leaving, at our website, publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. We have oleanders all over the North Carolina coast, and it's easy to see why. They're tolerant to heat and drought, and especially important right on the coast, they're tolerant to wind and salt spray. They have beautiful flowers on the terminal end of each stalk, and they can be white, cream, pink, red, lilac, apricot, yellow, that's my favorite, and purple. They love the sun, but can tolerate partial shade. And they can even tolerate poor soils. This year, and other really cold winter years, the oleander can be killed back all the way to the ground. And folks often aren't sure exactly what to do with it at that point. If you look around the coast right now, you see oleander that's just brown, no sign of life. That does not necessarily mean that the roots are dead. So some severe pruning is in order to get rid of the branches that are dead and to encourage new growth. Oleander can easily grow 1 to 2 feet or even more in a growth year. If, and here is the really big if, you take great care not to damage any new growth when you're pruning out the old growth. What does that mean? Well, don't take a pruning saw and just cut the entire bunch down right at the ground level right now. It's possible, as with some of our other shrubs, that new growth has already begun. And if you cut off the growing tip of those new branches, well, there goes this year's new oleander. So first, look very carefully at the plant. Pull apart the branches. Look all the way down to the soil. See if you see any new growing tips. And when you prune, prune cautiously and carefully to cut away only the old dead branches and not damage those new growing tips. As you're working with the oleander, do keep something extremely important in mind. Oleander is very, very poisonous. Eating even a small amount of any part can kill. Children have been poisoned by using the twigs as whistles or by roasting a hot dog on a stick. Don't let your pets chew on the branches that you're cutting off. It is even recommended that oleander not be planted near horse stalls, fence lines where animals are kept, or dog pens, especially if you have a pet that likes to chew. So keep all these in mind as you prune back the winter kill on your oleanders. And if a plant that is poisonous doesn't suit your long-term needs, think about that when you're buying new landscape plants. Also, if you have a wet soil, you're going to need to plant the oleanders on a berm. Like most plants, they do not tolerate wet feet. I look forward to seeing the beautiful oleander blooms this spring and hope you prune yours back and have wonderful regrowth. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Terry Tate, Certified Financial Planner with Raymond James Financial Services, offering comprehensive financial planning for your retirement and beyond. Terry Tate, CFP in New Bern, North Carolina, and online at terrytaite.biz.
Public Radio East is celebrating its 30th anniversary by helping to restore the striped bass population in eastern North Carolina. Each pledge made during our recent pledge drive meant 100 striped bass would be nurtured and then later released to our local rivers by the NC Wildlife Resources Commission. More than 500 people pledged during our membership drive, meaning that more than 50,000 striped bass will be finding their way to the Neuse and Tarpamaco rivers later this year. The striped bass is a valuable natural and economic resource to NC coastal rivers. More stripers mean healthier fisheries and more opportunities for anglers. Thank you, Public Radio East members, for helping replenish this natural resource.
Hello, Tom the Jazzman here, inviting you to join me this Sunday evening and every Sunday evening right here on Public Radio East. We play some of the finest jazz you'll hear anywhere in the world, and it's only right here on Public Radio East on all five frequencies every Sunday evening from 6 until 11 p.m. That's Tom the Jazz Man on PRE.
Followed by Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired at 11 p.m. on PRE Public Radio East News and Ideas.
This is the Down East Journal. It took a couple of stops, but Jason Adamo is now firmly settled in North Carolina, complete with a wife, something which might be mildly surprising to him, as his career plans originally had him trying his luck in the media capitals of the United States. Now he's trying to get recognition in those markets while working from his Raleigh base. George Olson spoke with Jason after the release of his first full CD, and has this, which originally aired in July of 2010.
Somewhere, someone is paying good money to have someone teach them certain vocal techniques, or they could just go to New York.
I actually played the subways to help pay my rent when I was up there, which was a great experience, and it really helped me to project my voice singing over the subway cars.
New York was a year-and-a-half stop for then-Virginia resident Jason Adamo before diverting from a planned Los Angeles relocation to move to North Carolina at his brother's behest and ultimately making Raleigh his permanent base. Projection learned in a New York City subway station isn't quite so necessary in the Pittsburgh studio, where Jason and band recorded his recently released first full-length CD, Transistor. For what Jason describes as a home studio operated by the disc producer John Briggs, it's a remarkably polished effort that harkens back to the classic rock era. Perhaps not too surprising, as Jason says the walls of the studio were plastered with Beatles posters, and he spent time during the recording reading a biography of the band. That Beatles-esque type of tunesmithing is what opens Transistor, with a song Jason wrote about his reflections on performing a showcase in Los Angeles last year, several years after abandoning the idea of pursuing his music career there.
It's a lot of people doing the same thing I was doing at that time, just making the trek to Los Angeles and trying to do what you need to do to make it to that next level. And the sad part of it is there's a lot of people who go there and their dreams, like I say in the song, are left right there on the airport floor next to the baggage claim. You know, once they get there, they do everything they can to try to make it, but they kind of get lost in a sea of other people trying to do the same thing.
Not getting lost in that sea of people is one of the things that has made basing his career out of Raleigh so enticing. He says in New York he got the opportunity to play some well-thought-of venues, but in a city with a million other things going on, you might be lucky to get 10 people showing up. Conversely, in Raleigh he says he's been able to develop a fan base where if you can get the word out about shows, people actually show up.
Also, when I moved down to Raleigh, I started realizing that there were some world-class musicians living in this area, in the Triangle, and you could catch them at any given night at an open mic or something, just coming out and playing for the love of music. And I was really kind of blown away at the amount of talent that was in this area. bands that have made it and since then have relocated to this area, or musicians who have been there and done that, and they still love playing. Even though they're not on the national scene anymore, they'll come out and play or whatever. But also just young talent that's on the way up as well. This Triangle area and North Carolina in general is chock full of great musicians.
Some of those musicians are a big part of Jason's new CD, Transistor, which is actually attributed to the Jason Adamo Band, and a band it is. Jason is the frontman, no doubt, but he collaborates with two other band members and brother Chris in varying combinations for 8 of the 13 songs on Transistor, with 2 more written solely by band member Doug Castine. Add in the tight production work by John Briggs. Musicians traveling to Nashville or elsewhere for studio time really need to Google this guy. And you've got a capital B band versus Jason and the Seven Dwarfs.
For instance, Rally Nights, that appears on the record in a more of an alt-country version of the song. John, he was producing the record. He was like, well, you know, you wrote that in January of 2009. Everything else has been written since. It's going into a different direction, this whole record. It's not that I'm not a fan of the song, but I'm not a fan of that version of the song being on this record. Because the original version of Rally Nights was a little bit more of a up-tempo kind of rock song. And one day we're just sitting in the studio and I start messing around with like a country version of Rally Nights on my guitar. And John was like, well, you know, if you play it like that, I'll put it on the record. And then we started messing around with harmonies on the chorus, and the whole song just took a turn in a better direction, I think. Take me home, now it's all right. I had enough to drink, let's put an end to this night. Take me home, it's all right. I had enough to drink, let's put an end to another rally night.
Transistor is a disc geared toward hooking you early. Jason says they front-loaded the disc with its catchiest tunes because in a landscape where a record label or radio station has hundreds of CDs for review sitting on a desk, if a disc doesn't get your attention in the first few tracks, it probably isn't going to get much further. Even with an eye toward marketing, Transistor has its moments where career calculation falls by the wayside just to highlight the sheer fun to be had making music, most obvious in the song Midnight Swings.
John Briggs brings in a suitcase out of his storage closet up the hall at his house, and I said, well, what are we doing with that? And he goes, well, we're about to record a blues song. I said, okay, well, we haven't written a blues song yet. And Doug said, well, I have. I've written some chords in this slide part on this guitar. And I had a stack of lyrics and poems that I had printed out for the Transistor sessions, and my brother Chris contributed the lyrics to that song. It was a really long poem called Midnight Swings. I just took 2 of the verses that he had wrote out of 10 verses and kind of put them together live while John was beating on the suitcase and Doug was playing slide acoustic guitar. I just started singing the lyrics to Midnight Swings, and those 3 core elements of the song are recorded live with a mic right in the middle of the room.
That kind of tune harkens back to Jason's days playing the subways in New York City. Nothing plugged in at all, just project enough to be heard over subway trains, or in this case, above the guy beating on a suitcase. Transistor is Jason's first full-length CD, but in those subway days, Jason could make a few dollars by selling a 6-song EP he released a few years back. Jason has embraced Raleigh's music scene, and it's embraced him. The video for Raleigh Nights will play on the Jumbotron at Raleigh's RBC Center during Carolina Hurricanes hockey games. But those subway days did allow Jason access to an audience he might not get passing through the turnstiles during hockey season.
New York being one of the biggest tourist attractions in the world, there's people from all over the world that would hopefully leave with a copy of my little put-together homemade CD that they would take home to Europe or wherever they were visiting from. And which was great because I would start getting emails from people across the ocean saying, hey, we heard you in subways of New York and we're spreading your music over here. The beauty of it was not only would it be a new crowd every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes, but it would be people from all walks of life throwing in a couple of bucks and grabbing a CD and leaving with your music or enjoying the experience with you.
Transistor is the new CD by the Jason Adamo Band. I'm George Olson. Kids.